Hello, and welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle. And today's program, we have a couple of different topics. We're going to look at lawn care with your turf grass. And in the first, but that's in the second half. In the first half, we're going to talk with Joel Karsten. He's an author and lecturer living in Minnesota. And he's written a book. And this book is all about how to grow a straw bale garden. It's entitled Straw Bale Gardens, The Breakthrough Method for Growing Vegetables Anywhere, Earlier, and with No Weeding. Joel is on the line with me. Joel, thank you for being with us for this first half of the program.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Okay. Now, I just, where did this idea come from? Because it's just not the first thing that would pop into my mind. I've tried growing potatoes with tires that had straw in them or some soil, but that's about as close as I ever would think about it. So tell me about where this came from.
Well, I'll tell you what. I grew up on a little crop and dairy farm down in the southwestern corner of Minnesota. Every once in a while, we'd have a bale that a string would break, and so we'd throw that straw bale up against the barn. And even as a little kid, I would notice that after 6 months or so or a year, that bale would start to sort of decompose right where it sat, and the big, huge thistles around the farmstead would grow right out of those straw bales, and they'd get to be the biggest and tallest ones. So I knew that there was some nutrients and some moisture and things being held in there. I go to college, I buy my first house. When I move into the house, I found out I have terrible soil in the backyard. And, of course, when you're young, you have no money to buy, you know, truckloads of soil brought in. So I thought, well, you know, those straw bales worked pretty well to grow thistles against the barn. Why wouldn't they work for me to try growing vegetables? So I did a bunch of experiments, tried a whole bunch of different techniques to get that straw bale, those straw bales to decompose more quickly so that I could plant in them faster, sort of get the timing down right. And turns out it worked really well. So now after 20 years of growing in straw bales, I always tell people that for the first 14 years, nobody really cared. But the last 6 years or so, after I got on TV one time, somebody came and did a little TV segment on it. And ever since then, there's just been really a lot of interest in this method of gardening and sort of taking the technique. And it's perfected to the point now where it's really a no-fail method of gardening. And I know you hear that lots of times, the no-fail method, but if you follow the step-by-step process, you can grow this garden in your parking lot if you want to. You don't even have to have good soil.
Now, will this translate to drier climes? And Minnesota, it is colder than Utah in a lot of sections, mm-hmm. but it also gets more moisture than yep. Utah does. We're lucky to have in the Cache Valley here in the northern part of state, maybe 15, 16 inches of moisture in an average year.
Well, I don't think it takes any more moisture than gardening in a traditional soil garden, but it probably doesn't take much less either. I had a woman email me last year from, she's out on the East Coast, I believe South or North Carolina, and she said the only water she used, she had a five-bale straw bale garden, and the only water she was using to water her garden because of water restrictions was the condensate from her air conditioner. So she said it was less than a gallon a day on five bales, and she kept her garden very nice. So I don't think it takes, you know, a lot of water. Straw has an amazing capacity to hold water inside the bale.
Yes, why straw versus having like a grass bale? Of course, well, a lot of agricultural areas here in the state of Utah, so you look at straw and you think, well, there's grass bales available. Your book points out why that's not a good idea.
Well, you know, I say it's not a good idea, although lots of people do use grass bales because it's the only thing they have available, so it's kind of out of desperation. But the reason straw works so much better is because the stems of the cereal grains, like oats and wheat and barley, et cetera, the stems are hollow. And so when water molecules touch the end of those stalks on the straw and the wheat, it sucks up inside of those stems, and that's able to hold lots of moisture inside that bale because it harbors inside of those stems. And, of course, the wheat and oats and barley are removed, the seeds from the stalk, so those are turned into Wheaties and oatmeal. So the bale, essentially, is just the baled-up stalks, which means it's weed-free. There's no seeds in it. If you take a bale of hay, usually that's baled up grass or baled up alfalfa, and that's going to be filled with seeds. Well, guess what happens if you water and fertilize a bale filled with seeds? You get a chia pet growing out in your garden. So.
Well, I want to make sure our listeners know that this is a live program. If you have any questions or comments, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. You can also send us an email question The address is zestygarden@gmail.com, or you can also tweet us your question, #zestygarden. And so I'm just thinking here, all right, so why use a bale versus planting in the ground initially?
Well, there's lots of advantages. Number one, you can obviously see when you look at a bale that's raised up off the ground. So that, you know, the raised height makes it more accessible for anybody with any kind of physical disabilities at all, or that just doesn't like to get down on their hands and knees in the soil.
Plus, it looks like good drainage. Even for folks around here that do raised bed gardening, it would be even better drainage because it's a little taller.
Right. Yeah, it's great drainage. It holds lots of moisture. But I'll tell you the number one advantage, particularly for folks in cooler climates like we are, is that those bales in the spring heat up as they begin to decompose. So we condition them to get them ready to plant, but that conditioning process is really involves composting the inside of that bale. And when you add that nitrogen and water to the bale and you start composting, it gets really hot inside that bale. We don't plant when it's super hot, but as soon as it cools down after a couple weeks, we put our plants in there. And when we're planting here in Minnesota on May 15th, the soil temperature is about 50 degrees. The temperature inside that bale might be close to 100 degrees when we plant in there. So our plants tend to grow much faster earlier in the season, get really rapid root production early in the season. So it tends to shorten your days to maturity length a little bit with certain crops. And, of course, the overall number one thing people love about it is you don't have to pull weeds, because in a straw bale garden there's really essentially no weeding involved.
Well, let's talk about the basics then, about what you need. My first question is how early in the year can you start this? We just got a skiff of snow yesterday. You're, I think, getting like 4 to 6 inches of snow today. So,
yeah, not far from here in Rochester. They're under 10 inches right now this morning. So, yeah, it's a bummer. You know, I tell people to target what your typical planting date is, at least for your first year of straw bale gardening, because I don't want to put all of these requirements on you at once. So think about what your normal planting date is, then I want you to start 12 days before that date and get your bales conditioned. So you need to get the bales, get them home, get them set up, and then you begin the conditioning process. And that period of time takes about 12 days. If you want to do your bales using 100% organic techniques, if you're an organic gardener, then I would give yourself about 18 days. You need just a few more days if you want to do it organically. But so if you can plan ahead that 2 or 3 week period of time just before the planting time, your typical planting time. Now, in the future, I'm going to challenge gardeners to plant a little bit earlier, which is always makes you nervous when you're putting things out a little earlier. This year I would be shaking my boots if I was planting things early because of all the snow we've had. But I think we're going to go from this terrible winter immediately into summer here in the next couple weeks. So we're going to skip through spring. So I think people will be ready to plant still by middle of May here in Minnesota. And if you just target that date, so you work backwards on your calendar 2 weeks, you'll be all ready to go.
If you've never done this before then, or maybe you're a garden novice, are there certain vegetables or flowers or any type of plant that you would suggest starting out with first instead of trying to do a whole bunch at one time?
Well, you must grow some tomatoes for sure. This is the greatest way on planet Earth to grow tomatoes, mainly because we're all familiar with tomatoes and how they're so susceptible to verticillium wilt and septoria leaf spot and, you know, other disease problems, and you'll get that defoliation in the middle of the summer and your tomato crop doesn't turn out very well. And that disease problem is harbored from year to year in the soil right underneath your tomato plant. So the master gardeners will always tell you, well, you can't grow tomatoes in the same spot year after year because you need to try to prevent that disease. Well, in a straw bale, we don't have to worry about that disease. We never have to worry about crop rotation because we're literally creating our own brand new soil inside of this bale every year. We're turning that straw into soil, which has no leftover disease from the previous year or leftover insect problems that harbor in that bale either. So tomatoes is a wonderful crop to grow. You'll impress all your neighbors with how great your tomatoes are. And potatoes. I always tell people, if you try anything, try growing potatoes. They do marvelously well in a bale of straw, as do, you know, your typical broccoli and cauliflower and peas and beans and carrots and, you know, everything else.
Do you know, the light bulb just went on for me, because in my garden, I have wilt problems with my potatoes. I cannot grow Pontiac potatoes because they just die back early. But if I did potatoes with straw bales, I wouldn't have to worry about any pathogens in the soil because there's nothing in the bale.
Right. Yeah. It's virgin soil inside of that bale.
Also, melons, watermelon just dies back around here as well. So, okay. Now I'm getting a little bit more excited. So tell me exactly what are you going to need? If you're just going to do a couple of bales in your book, it's showing, you know, trellis systems and stakes and so forth. How much what's the bare minimum that you would need to get started?
Well, you need a couple bales of straw and a bag of lawn fertilizer, and that'll really get you going. You know, I tell people, if you want to do it organically, you can use a source of nitrogen like blood meal or feather meal. Work really well. If you have composted poultry manure, you can mix some of that in with your blood meal and feather meal to make it go a little bit further. But you're going to apply that every other day for a period of 10 days, water it down into the bale. If you're going to do it using lawn fertilizer, it just takes a half a cup of lawn fertilizer every other day for 10 days. Just make sure your lawn fertilizer doesn't have any herbicides in it. That's what's important. No herbicides. It can't be weed and feed or something like that. So if you're going to grab an old bag of lawn fertilizer out of your potting shed, you need to read the label and make sure that there's no crabgrass preventer or weed and feed or anything like that in that bag. Otherwise, that lawn fertilizer will work fine. We're not real picky about what we use.
Should it be a slow release nitrogen or quicker release?
Well, it should be a faster release, which is usually a cheaper fertilizer, which is a good thing. If you use the slow release, it takes longer during the season before that becomes available. And so we certainly don't want that, to take a long time to get ready. So if the fertilizer is fast release, put it on half a cup every day, 10 days, water it in every day after you put the fertilizer on, and you'll see 12 days later your bales will be nicely decomposing, conditioned, and ready to plant.
Now, what I like about your book is it's showing exactly what, not only what you can grow, but exactly how to do things, even pictures of the fertilizer, the different tools that you will need. So it looks very helpful that way.
Yeah, I tell people for tools, you can leave your rototiller and your hoe and your rake and your shovel all in the garden shed this year. All you need is a hand trowel to do all your gardening in the bales. So it really doesn't take a lot of tools.
You also have a listing of what to do on each of the days, so you make sure you stay on top of things. So with the nitrogen, for instance, if you've got on that first day, you're going to be getting the bale full of water. How long does it take to actually get that bale full?
You'll sit there and water that bale for at least 3 or 4 minutes because it'll suck up and hold a big average size dry bale of straw will suck up and hold about between 6 and 8 gallons of water. So it holds quite a bit of water that first day. Now the second day, all you're going to add is about a gallon and you'll see water coming out the bottom already because that bale will be fully saturated inside from the first day. So after the first day where it does take quite a bit of water, after that you'll see it doesn't take much at all to get that bale so the water's coming out the bottom.
So plan on about 12 days, and then the day 12 is when you'll be planting.
Yep, day 12. On a typical year, day 12 is perfect. Now, you'll know you're ready to plant because you can take the temperature of that bale. If you've got a meat thermometer, if you've got a compost thermometer, if you don't have either of those, just shove your hand down inside the bale. Use that meat thermometer. And if your hand feels nice and if it feels hot on your hand, it's too hot to plant, so you should wait one more day. But if it feels comfortable or cool on your hand, then it's okay to plant in that bale. During the two-week conditioning, it's very common that those bales will get up to 130, 135 degrees inside the bale. So there's a lot of bacterial activity down inside there, and that the byproduct of that is it gives off lots of heat.
So these little critters that are doing the eating and heating things up, they're already within the bale?
They're already in there. Yep, there's bacteria everywhere. All they need is a source of food and a little bit of water, and the food is that lawn fertilizer or blood meal we're giving them. They eat that nitrogen and they reproduce themselves. That's their only goal in life. Make more bacteria and consume organic material. That's their only two objectives, and that's what they're going to do inside of that bale. That's what, you know, decomposes all organic material all over planet Earth is what does the majority of it is bacteria. And you got some insects. You'll see some bugs down inside there and beetles. You'll also see some worms, which are really important to decomposition. And you also see some mushrooms that will sprout off your bales. Fungi does a lot of decomposition for us as well.
Now, as far as the bale itself, does it tend to break apart. I know you've got the baling twine that goes around it, so I'm assuming that should be on the side as far as how you're orienting the bale.
Right.
I'm also thinking north to south they should be going, so you catch the best sun each direction.
Yep, that's exactly right. I can tell you've read the book. that's really true. The strings will help hold the bale together. I also tell people that the outside edges of your straw bale, you know, they're exposed to the wind and the sun all day long, so they dry out right away when that bale gets wet, and that outside edge of straw sort of forms a crust. And by the end of the season, you'll see that crust becomes sort of the vessel or the container for the media on the inside, which is the straw that has now literally transformed into soil.
Okay, so you're adding nutrients into this. You're getting it full. I'm kind of moving into exactly how do you get seeds into there? What's the process of getting something planted within the bale?
Well, if you're going to plant transplants, all you need to do is dig a little hole in the straw bale. You can use your trowel to make a little hole, or you can literally use a pliers. If your bales are really tightly bound, sometimes you got to use a pliers to pull a little bit of straw out in order to get your pot down inside there. And then if you're going to seal up any root hairs that are exposed during that transplant, don't go take a shovel of soil out of your garden, because now you just brought all kinds of problems from your weed seeds and your potential disease, etc. So you need to get one bag of sterile planting mix to put around it. If you're going to put seeds in, you need to frost the cake. Put about an inch or so of sterile planting mix, potting mix, right on top of your bale, and then you seed directly in that sterile planting mix. That will hold moisture, and it will hold your seed in place until that seed has a chance to germinate. When the root comes out, it's going to go straight down into that bale where all the new soil and nutrients are. So you just need a thin little coating. You'll see one bag of planting mix will do five bales pretty easily.
We have our first caller. We have Barbara in North Logan. Hi, Barbara. How can we help?
Good morning. You're really enjoying the show, and I'm envisioning straw bales that could be piled up into like little walls here and there to make it higher for some of us older folks who don't want to bend over as much. But a question I have in our climate is the exposure with the extreme sun that we have at our altitude and what you do to protect those sides so they don't lose moisture, because we don't get a lot of wind, but we have a lot of sun and very, very, very hot sun that can dry out a garden very quickly. And now you've just elevated it and exposed several sides. So what do you recommend for protecting? Do you grow plants over the edges? Do you put trellises in front along the sides? But if you wanted to go up like two or three bales and actually make like a path of garden, a wall path with these on them, what would you do with those sides to minimize moisture loss in an arid climate like we have?
Well, I think you hit on both of them in your question. One is you plant the sides. A lot of times when people look at a bale, they say, well, there's just that little surface on the top. How do you get enough plants? Because I plant the sides of my bales as well. Most of the bales in my garden, I plant filled with all kinds of herbs. I put my basil, my chives, my oregano, everything goes in the sides of the bales. So literally it's hard to see any exposed straw bale when the garden is completely in full leaf, because there's stuff coming out of the sides, and, of course, the top is all planted. So that definitely takes care of it, because those plants are going to shade the bales. Also, we're going to run a soaker hose, water hose, right down the top center of those straw bales. So in the morning when you turn your water on and you wet those bales down, you'll be really amazed at how much moisture stays inside of those bales. I mean, if you think about it, straw's main agricultural use throughout eternity has been animal bedding, livestock bedding. Why does it work so well for livestock bedding? Because it's so absorptive. It sucks up all that wetness in the animal pen and allows you to be able to remove that. And it does the same thing in our garden. It sucks up and holds all that water inside the bale and makes it available for our plants. If you wanted to put something like a little little wooden fence or a board or something along the edges of your bale. I have people down in Arizona and places like that swear by putting, this plastic fencing. They kind of fold it over and they push it up next to the bales and kind of wrap it around their bales, and they say that works better. I don't necessarily do anything other than put plants in the sides of mine. Even flowers. I mean, annual flowers do really well. You can plug some marigolds and patience and petunias or whatever you want into the sides of the bale. So not only are you growing stuff out the top, but it looks pretty as well.
Oh, great. I can't wait to get started.
Great.
Well, good luck with your garden. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Thanks, Barbara. If you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. You can tweet us your question at hashtag AUGarden, and then you can also email us your question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. On the line with us is Joel Karsten. He's the author of the book Straw Bale Gardens, The Breakthrough Method for Growing Vegetables Anywhere, Earlier, and with No Weeding. Joel, one thing I read in your book was how things can slow down if you're using cold water to get things started. Why don't you address that a little bit?
Well, you know, if you use water from a deep well, it comes out of the ground about 50 degrees or so, so it's pretty chilly. And I tell people to, on the off day, when you're not fertilizing and you don't have to spray down into the bale, you could just use a gallon or so of warm water. Now, if you're right next to your kitchen where your garden is, you could just bring water out there that's nice and warm out of the tap. But if you're out in the middle of the yard somewhere and you don't want to, you got 20 bales to do, all I recommend is that you fill up some 5-gallon pails with water today and then use that water tomorrow, because it'll warm up at least to whatever the air temperature is, so you won't be dousing those bales with freezing, you know, real chilly water. And that, of course, that slows down the bacterial reproduction process. So it just helps speed up the conditioning a little bit.
Yeah, I noticed in your book it tends to slow down the reproduction process no matter what the animal is.
Yeah, exactly. Squirt anything with cold water in it. Sort of takes the incentive of reproduction away, for sure.
Okay, so you talked about the soaker hose going on top of the bale, and I'm assuming you should do that before you actually do planting?
Yeah, it's good to run those soaker hoses, and then I always tell people to put a little wire, sort of a little strap, over the hose just to hold it right in the middle of the bale until your plants get up. And once your stems are all around that soaker hose, now it'll stay in place. But early in the season, every time your water pressure kicks on, that hose is going to jump a little bit, and it'll walk its way right off the top of the bale. So it's a good idea to put a little stake in there to hold it in place.
Okay, so you've got the water going. You've got your plants. You're getting ready to put them in. So how do you know if the bale is ready to go? My concern would be, okay, maybe it's still a little too hot on the inside. You talked about putting your hand down in there. If you plant the plants when it's too hot, what's going to happen?
Well, you're going to cook them. You'll just see that they don't do well. They'll get wilty and limp if it's just too hot inside that bale. Now, if you catch it and it, you know, the plants are looking a little bit peaked, all you really need to do is douse it really good. And this time, you'd want to use nice cold water around the roots, and that'll, you know, slow down the transpiration of that plant a little bit, and it will, you know, improve. It'll perk back up again. But if it gets super hot inside that bale, if your bales are not done conditioning and you plant too early, your plants are going to croak. They're going to die right off. You're going to have to go back and retransplant new plants in there. I get emails from people once in a while in the spring, and they'll say, Joe, I tried straw bale gardening and it didn't work. I put 3 tomatoes in my bale last week, and now they're all dead. And I email them back and I say, well, tell me what you did for the conditioning process to get the bales ready. And they'll email back and they'll say, well, I don't understand. What does conditioning mean? So they just planted plants in a raw straw bale. And if you do that, they're going to die very quickly, because they're going to heat up as you put that in there, and it's just going to cook them. So it doesn't work. You have to condition in advance before you plant.
Okay, so you've conditioned the bale. Say you've got some tomato plants. You're not going to start them from seed outside, at least not around here you can.
Nope.
So you've got your plants. Tell me the process of getting that plant in the bale.
Well, wedge a little hole or pull some straw out, put just so it's deep enough to get the roots down in. Backfill a little bit with your sterile planting mix. If you're going to do it from seeds, just make a coating over the top. Then I tell people, don't plant in rows. You know, when you look at the back of a seed pack, it'll tell you the in-the-row spacing for carrots is 2 inches. So you make one long row 2 inches apart. Usually people sprinkle them in, then you got to come back and thin them out. But if you're going to do that on a straw bale, what I would recommend is you plant 2 inches apart in a checkerboard pattern so that you almost have 6 rows of width and then the whole length of the bale. 2 inches apart in all directions on the surface of that bale. So you can get a lot of carrots in the top of one straw bale. Then on the other end of the bale, you're going to throw a tomato in there, because tomatoes don't get, you know, real big and mature until your carrots are already up and gone. So once you harvest the carrots, you might put some broccoli back in there and get a late crop of broccoli as well. So you're succession planting this bale as well. Every time you harvest one crop, you're planting something else right behind it to keep those bales full and producing for the entire summer.
So how often do you have to water once you get your plants planted and they're looking great the first day? How are you going to keep them growing well?
Well, in the spring, you probably only need to water every other day, every third day, because, you know, they'll hold quite a bit of water for quite a while. And there's not a lot of top production and not a lot of roots yet. But when you get to midsummer, you're going to have to water more than likely every day. You know, if you get big tomato plants in there, those tomatoes will suck up a lot of water out of that bale. So you need to make sure that that bale gets watered pretty much every day during the heat of summer when you're really producing a lot of crop.
And tomatoes don't like to dry out. They like to have consistent moisture. Otherwise, you end up getting blossom end rot. So
I'll tell you a great technique you can use if you want to make sure you don't ever have a lack of moisture, and that's to use an indicator plant somewhere in your straw bale garden. And I like to use an impatient flower. Normally, impatiens are just going to grow in the shade and nice, moist environment. But if you put them in full sun, they're going to be very water sensitive. So they have shallow roots, and they'll start to droop a little bit if they have any lack of moisture in their roots. They'll get droopy. And you can look out your kitchen window, and you can see that droopy little impatient, and you know you need to get out there and get some water on that garden. So it's the first plant in your garden that'll show you that there's some water stress, so you know to run out there and water.
How often do you have to continue fertilizing?
You know, throughout the summer, every time you add more water, you're going to see when you condition the bales that you get a little buildup of some of that fertilizer on the top of the bale, kind of forms a little crust. So every time you water the bales, you're washing a little bit more fertilizer down into that bale. If you see that your plants are showing any kind of what we call chelation, which is where the in between the veins of the leaves will turn a little bit lime green. If that happens, it's a sign that you have some nutrient deficiencies, and you can add a little bit of fertilizer, foliar fertilizer. If you're a traditional gardener, you could use, you know, Miracle-Gro or some soluble fertilizer. If you're organic, it would be fish emulsion or, you know, kelp meal or something like that to get your nutrients into that plant. But throughout the summer, I maybe only fertilize mine maybe once or twice through the whole summer, because most of the nutrients are down in that bale already after the conditioning process.
Okay, so you could, if you wanted to, use an extended release fertilizer if you wanted to, after you've gotten the bale going.
Sure, if you wanted to, absolutely. Just like you would in a normal, in your regular soil garden. You know, a little bit of extra fertilizer is always helpful.
Well, I'm running out of time. I just want to keep going, but I have a couple of questions that I think need to be addressed. So what should you not grow in a straw bale?
I would not recommend sweet corn. You're going to get, you know, two stalks of corn out of a great big bale, so because they have such huge root systems. Also, don't grow perennial vegetables, things like rhubarb and asparagus that are going to come back year after year, because your bale, essentially, many people will use them a second year for their short season crops like broccoli, things like that, that grow really fast. But you don't want to use a second year bale for tomatoes because it doesn't heat up again the second year. It's all done conditioning. It's not going to get hot again. And we want that heat for our long season squash and our tomatoes.
So the bale is essentially broken down.
Yeah, it's broken down. It'll be, and after two seasons of growth, that bale will be nothing but a little bit of pile of soil sort of piled up there. Now, don't ever throw that away, because you can use that leftover straw bale compost, finish it, you know, put it in a little separate pile, finish it up. Now it works great to improve all kinds of other soil throughout your garden. You can use it to fill up your window boxes and fill up your big pots with your annual flowers. That straw bale compost is really some nice stuff. The following year, you can certainly use it. So, you know, other than that, we really haven't found many plants that don't love this environment, because when straw breaks down, it gives you a real neutral pH. It has lots of nutrients. It's well-drained. So it's a really favorable environment for most vegetables that we're all familiar with. They love this environment.
I was going to say, here where our soils are really quite alkali, that this could be a big boost.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm seeing pictures here in the book. I'm seeing strawberries. I'm seeing herbs. I'm seeing flowers, summer annuals, at least what would be here, like dahlias. We cannot keep them over the winter, but they would work well in this.
Yeah, you know, you don't have to dig up and plant them in the spring, dig up the soil, and then you got to dig them up in the fall in order to store your bulbs. Just put your dahlias, your caladiums, your gladiolus, calla lilies, put those in your bale. When the flower stems come up, cut the flowers and use them in your vase in the house to make a nice display, and then let the vegetation stay in the bale. That fall, you come back, you cut the strings, and out comes, instead of one glad bulb that you planted, now you have three gladiolus bulbs, because it'll triplicate inside that bale. Pick up all your bulbs, and you didn't even have to dig up the soil to get your bulbs back.
Well, I love it. And again, we've been listening and talking to Joel Karsten. He's the author of the book Straw Bale Gardens, The Breakthrough Method for Growing Vegetables Anywhere Earlier and with No Weeding. Copies of his book are available online through his website, strawbalegardens.com. Joel, thank you for joining me this morning.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really, really appreciate the opportunity very much. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Coming up next, we'll have Kelly Cope, and we're going to be talking about turf grass. And if you have any questions for Kelly, toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495 or zestygarden@gmail.com. Right now, we're going to hear the latest in what I'm calling the Petals and Prose segment. It's from Nancy Williams.
Good gardeners pay attention to death and decomposition. Autumn and winter are necessary parts of the wheel of life, and we have learned that not only does compost happen naturally in life, but good compost is part of what makes our gardens thrive. Sometimes when you see a very wilted flower that has fallen out of a vase of water, you can take that flower, and instead of just throwing it away, you can recut the stem and place it in fresh water, and it will get rejuvenated, writes Elizabeth Murray in her book, Cultivating Sacred Space, Gardening for the Soul. It will become beautiful and full and open again. This is what happens to our souls with love and with beauty. And this is what can happen in the garden when we're close to nature and we're surrounded by this beauty. When our souls feel weary and wilted, they can become regenerated. It is also what happens to the soil itself when it has been trashed and cemented over, like in Lily Ye's inner city plot in Philadelphia, or like Gerald's reclaimed land, which had been raped and abused as a gravel pit. And then new life emerges. The moisture comes back. With sunshine and love and radiance, new life happens and new blossoms come forward. There is a renewal, Elizabeth writes. She continues, with that renewal, we can also be nurtured by our experiences and by our past. Like compost, our experiences can be part of the source, the dark depth that our roots draw from. This is where compassion and empathy come from. It is the source of our growth, and it teaches us how to nurture ourselves. I have learned about infinity, the life-death-life cycle, from nature, she writes. When something dies, whether it is a tree on the forest floor or a cutting from my garden thrown in the compost pile, it breaks down. It changes form, and it creates richness and food for the rest of life. Insects, worms, and bugs. Trees get nurture from this breaking down. Mushrooms come. Animal life feeds off of that. The same is true with our love. It keeps regenerating. When someone dies, they're not really gone completely. Their energy continues, and it continues to nurture us. We can draw from that. In this way, we come to know the eternal, the continuum of life. I was thinking about the life-death-life cycle this morning when I found a Zesty Gardener's obituary in the Salt Lake Tribune. Now, I confess to being a lifelong obit reader, but this gem is going into my permanent collection. Let me share some of the excerpts with you. This is for Norma Wolf Briscoe, 1916 to 2013. Quote, devoted to her family, her church, and the rich soil of her garden, Norma Briscoe lived a long and productive life. She died April 19, 2013, as she lived, happy, at peace, and full, on her way home from a favorite meal. She was 96. For an old lady who is legally blind, deaf, and half dumb, I think I'm doing pretty well, she would say, setting aside the pains and serious ailments of her final year with a spunky, positive outlook. She was an environmentalist and frugal preservationist who would rather sew an old garment than buy a new one. She got more joy in planting and teaching than in harvesting or consuming. Norma was a pioneering organic gardener, always ready to share her knowledge and skill with others, as well as the products of her garden and kitchen. The day before she passed away, she had been digging into her lush compost, preparing her big backyard garden in holiday for another season of flowers, herbs, and vegetables. She planned to cut back with only 5 tomato plants this year, but told her son Roscoe that she might as well plant the full row of 20. She left a thriving, loving family and a blossoming spring garden full of new life. Norma was a creative spirit and a humble artist who worked with the bounties of the earth, always collecting seeds, pods, dried weeds, cattails, and all sorts of odds and ends. She referred to death as moving on to her next assignment. Like a true gardener, she wanted a humble epitaph. Quote, "Here lies Norma, still composting." Norma's toughness and tolerance for people of other races and beliefs, and her quiet support for civil rights, including gay rights and gay marriage, set her apart as a progressive example for the women of her family, her church, and her generation. "Physically, I plan to simplify my life," she wrote, "then put in as much gardening as my ailing, aching back will stand. But most importantly, I plan to keep the faith and endure to the end." And that's exactly what she did. Thanks for being here with me today. Again, the book that I shared from is called Cultivating Sacred Space, Gardening for the Soul by Elizabeth Murray. This is Nancy Williams for The Zesty Garden.
Thank you, Nancy. You'll be hearing various selections from Nancy in the coming weeks. And if you have anything interesting that you'd like to read, give us a call, 1-800-826-1495, or you can email us at zestygarden@gmail.com. In our community calendar, we have a few items to make mention of. First, there is a workshop tonight on rainwater storage. It's from 6:30 to 8 o'clock p.m. in Logan at the Willow Park Zoo's Learning Center classroom. It's free, and the description says, "Make the most of the rain that falls on the yard and garden," from Utah Water Watch coordinator Brian Green and licensed landscape architect Kevin Jensen. Topics will include the proper use, maintenance, and regulation of rain barrels and how to use your landscape to harvest and channel water via features such as bioswales and rain gardens. And then Cache County Extension is offering their Alternascapes Tour 2013. It's earlier this year than normal, about a month and a half earlier. It's a self-guided tour of 9 gardens in Providence, Nibley, and Hiram, featuring gardens with greenhouses, hoop houses, cold frames, and other ways to keep plants producing on both ends of the season. It's sponsored by the Cache County Master Gardeners and the Utah Native Plant Society. Tickets are $5, and they're available at the Cache County Extension Office, 179 North Main in Logan, or on the day of the Alternascapes tour at the Information Center at Zollinger Park at 61 North, 200 West in Providence. And then Wasatch Community Gardens is having their annual plant sale on May 11th from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. in the Roland Hall School parking lot, 720 South Guardsman Way in Salt Lake City. The sale will feature more than 30,000 plants, including heirloom tomatoes, vegetable starts, herbs, annual flowers, grasses, waterwise plants, Utah natives, and edible perennials. Information is at wasatchgardens.org. We're going to transition into the second half of the program. Kelly Cope, USU's Extension Turfgrass Specialist, is my guest. Thanks for coming in, Kelly.
Thanks, Brian.
I'm going to have you come back because we just talked about straw bale gardens for so long, but I've got a ton of questions for you as well.
Sure, fascinating.
The first one that I wanted to make sure that we began talking about are, because I've had some questions about warm season grasses and can you plant them and put them in? Mm-hmm. And I've noticed that our neighbor across the street, there's been several people that have moved in and out and in and out. They've had buffalo grass in a certain section. Mm-hmm. And I love how it looks and it's low maintenance, but there are some things to consider when putting in these warm season grasses.
Certainly there are. Probably the main thing that folks should know about the warm season grasses is that they have a different active growing season than the cool season grasses that we typically grow here in the state. So where grasses like Kentucky bluegrass have their most aggressive growth in the spring and the fall, these warm season grasses have their most aggressive growth in the middle of the summer. So I, when I'm talking with folks about their options, I always mention that, you know, if your intention is to really use and be active on the grass in the middle of the summer, this is something to consider, these warm season grasses. On the other hand, because of their growth cycle, they are going to be greening up a little bit more slowly in the spring, and they'll go dormant a little more quickly in the fall. So as I talk with folks around the state, that seems to be the major concern. But as you say, there are a number of folks who are growing warm season grasses, and not just buffalo grass, but others as well, very successfully in the state. And I'm also the water conservation specialist, and so I'm always thinking water as well as turf, and they are extremely efficient in terms of water use. So I think they're a great option in many places in the state.
So is it, when they go dormant, is it basically by nighttime temperatures or is it average temperature overall? Because I'm thinking in the fall around here, it still gets pretty warm during the daytime, but the nights really cool off quite a bit.
Right. I think the major temperature factor is more with what's happening in the soil. So as our general temperatures decrease and the soil temperatures start to decrease, that affects root activity and the plant's ability to sustain top growth. So that's typically what's happening. And, you know, it really depends on the year, too. I think it's important to note that we can talk about general timing of these things, but as you well know, our weather is so unpredictable. This spring has just amazed me.
It went from warm and no moisture in March to very cold and almost average moisture in April. I thought the Iris Society that I'm the president of here in Logan would have to have our show moved up. And now we're looking at actually having to move it back.
So. I know. It's just so unpredictable. And so in any given year, that dormancy that I talked about with the warm season grasses is going to change. So they may green up a little earlier in some years that are particularly warm. You know, if we do have a particularly warm fall, they'll be growing pretty actively into September. So it really just depends on what we're seeing on a year-to-year basis. But they will be most active and most attractive in the middle of the summer. So June, July, I would say. July, August would be their best period.
So 2 and 3 years ago when we had these cold, wet springs, and I think 2 years ago was even into June, would they still be looking not very good?
That's right, yes. Okay. Yes. But, you know, everything was slow then.
Yes.
Right. You know, to be fair,
you couldn't even plant corn. You couldn't plant your tomatoes. Yeah.
Right. Right. So, you know, I think that real gardeners, hardy gardeners, zesty gardeners are folks that could certainly handle and manage these plants. And as you say, with your neighbor, particularly buffalo grass of the warm season grasses can just be so, so attractive. It's just incredibly soft. It has this really lovely blue gray color. And if you have a dominance of male plants. It is a grass species that has both male and female plants. They have seed heads that sort of shoot up above the canopy of the grass, and it can just have this really attractive appearance when they're blowing in the wind.
Like, I mean, kind of a little sheen to the grass.
Yeah, yeah, a little bit of a white, you know, you can envision teeny tiny white flowers over the top that blow in the breeze, you know. At the same time, you can also mow it just as you would a standard lawn, and it'll be very uniform and neat and tidy, and if that's your thing, great. You don't have to let it grow with the flowers, but you can.
So it takes traffic?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, it's extremely traffic tolerant. It's what we call a stoloniferous grass, which means it has above ground runners. So these runners, you know, they can literally cross sidewalks and driveways. They can be pretty aggressive. But what that does is it lends a lot of traffic tolerance to this grass and helps it to fill in really well.
So you would have to be careful of it around flower beds, for instance?
Yes, but no more so than you would typical
regular grass.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Kentucky bluegrass has the same sort of structure, except that it goes below ground. And so that's why you sometimes see the single blade of grass popping up in your flower bed, and you're thinking, where did that come from? But it's usually got a below ground stem that's bringing it up to that point.
So where do you find buffalo grass? Is it something that you plant from seed, or is it from plugs?
You can do either. And there are a few different varieties, both seeded as well as vegetative varieties. And vegetative would be the ones that are planted from plugs. And resources for those, I'd encourage you to check on the USU Extension website. We've got a bulletin on cultivars of turf grasses to use in Utah. And we address where you can get those either seeds or plugs, as well as which ones we recommend. Because I don't know if folks are aware, but within these different turf species, there are many, many varieties. And so we do a lot of work to identify those that do the best here in Utah.
Can you usually find buffalo grass locally, or do you have to order it?
Well, there are a few local sources that come to mind. One of those is Granite Seed in Lehi, Utah, and they've actually got a pretty nice website that you can check out. There is, local sources as well. There is a sod grower in the Salt Lake area called Biograss. They're another great resource. So there are local resources. There are also resources across the nation. You can buy plugs and have them shipped to you, and they travel very well. It's not something that you have to worry about. It's not like trying to ship a tomato plant, for example. And so there are lots of resources for the plugs as well.
So you can... You can cut it like regular sod and transplant it that way? I didn't even thought about that.
Yes.
So it grows thickly enough that it stays together.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So, and the grower that I mentioned is one of the most progressive growers in the state, and he's kind of taken that on, which is nice to see. Nice to see.
Well, if you have any questions, Kelly is here for about another 8 minutes. Our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. You can email us your question at zestygarden@gmail.com, or you can tweet us your question if you want to go that far, and it's #AUGarden. All right, so with these warm season grasses, when do you get them started?
Okay.
I know like Kentucky bluegrass, you should be doing that. You know, you could be doing that right now.
You could also wait till the fall for those. But with the warm season grasses, it's really important to focus on when they're going to be actively growing. So that timing that we just mentioned for Kentucky bluegrass coincides with its most active growing periods, the temperatures that it likes. So with the warm season grass, you want to focus that timing when it's growing most aggressively. So the earliest would be May. Better would be June. You could even get going into July, but you don't want to go beyond that because you want it to get established before temperatures start to cool off.
And one of the positives for it is that it does not grow very fast. In other words, or tall. You don't have to mow
it as much. Right. Excellent point. That's with buffalo grass, not all the warm seasons. But yes, buffalo grass, it'll get to be about 6 inches high, and that's about it. It'll stop there. So it's a grass that, you know, I think makes a terrific lawn, but it's also a grass that's got a real application to areas where you may not be able or want to mow a lot. And it still looks pretty tidy. And that's typically pretty important to folks who are growing grasses. So, yeah, it does not grow that tall.
Do you have any other suggestions for warm season grasses?
Well, let's see. Blue Grama is one that is an option here in the state. Zoysia grass is another. If you live in Washington County, only Washington County, you can actually use Bermuda grass. In other counties in the state, Bermuda grass is still on the noxious weed list. So, again, only Washington County. And so those are a few options there.
So zoysic grass will grow in northern Utah?
It will. It will. And actually, when I first moved to Utah, I had a lot of questions about it. And that's when it was being actively advertised in the magazine that accompanies the Sunday newspaper.
Yes.
Yes. And so I was getting a lot of questions about it. But it certainly can grow here. It does very well.
And as far as the Bermuda grass, it won't grow in northern Utah just because it just gets killed out?
Oh, it will.
It will grow.
It's on, yes, that's why it's on the noxious weed list.
Ah, okay.
But that's because it's the old common type of Bermuda grass that's the noxious weed. The ones that are grown all over this country, by the way, are the hybrid Bermuda grasses. And they are beautiful. And they are not aggressive. And I am hoping that at some point in the future, Bermuda grass will be removed from that noxious weed list in the other counties in the state, and that it'll be an option for other folks. It's just an amazing grass in terms of wear tolerance. I mean, it's the grass that's used on golf course greens and tees and in the southern part of the country. I mean, it's nice stuff. So we just have to get over a little bit of let's call it Bermuda grass prejudice.
Yeah, well, I've got a prejudice to it. I went to my uncle's place in Pensacola, Florida. I'm like, what is this sticky, stiff stuff you've got, you call for a lawn?
That might have been St. Augustine grass.
Oh, okay. So
yeah,
so Bermuda grass is a little softer?
Much softer.
Okay.
Much softer, much finer blade. I tell people that St. Augustine grass, it's kind of like cabbage. I grew up with that stuff. I mean, it has got a beefy blade and stem, and we used to chew on it when I was a kid. I mean, it is really thick, tough stuff. Bermuda grass is not like that.
Okay.
So, but again, I'm talking about the hybrid Bermuda grasses, not the common.
So if you had a place that you're gonna plant grass, what would you do as the water conservation and turf grass specialist?
Oh, my. Well, that's a conversation that I have with a lot of folks, and it usually ends up being a decision based mostly on how the area is going to be utilized. If there are children, pets, if you intend to have a lot of play and traffic on an area, I would suggest probably bluegrass. It's still a grass that I think has a lot of application in the state. Delving a little bit deeper there, though, it would be a bluegrass, tall fescue, fine fescue mixture, something like that. So you have a little bit of diversity there. But those grasses can be utilized very effectively in the state. And honestly, my water conservation efforts have gotten to be a lot more focused on irrigation and irrigation systems and how efficiencies can be improved there. Because a lot of these grasses that we use in the landscape, you can really push them pretty far in terms of water conservation and reducing water. And a lot of the excesses that I see in the state have to do with irrigation systems and how people either do or don't know how to use their irrigation controller. So that's what I focus on a lot.
So, and we've talked on the program about this, that bluegrass really is quite drought tolerant. It just doesn't look very good when it goes dormant.
That's right. That's right. You know, another thing I emphasize with folks is that if bluegrass goes dormant because you're being conservative with the water, that's fine. It'll come back very reliably when temperatures are better.
Okay. Well, we don't have a lot of time left in the program. We might have one question coming in that we'll try to get to here. Kelly Cope is USU's Water Conservation and Turf Grass Specialist. Do you ever have any issues saying that? You probably used to it.
Not usually.
Okay, it's just me. And we hope that you'll get the information that you need. And our caller is Leanne in Vernal. Hi, Leanne. How can we help?
Hi. I recently read a little bit about using clover in a cool grass garden to help fix nitrogen and just generally as a good addition. Does that work in northern Utah?
Oh, definitely. It's funny because clover has sort of almost the same situation as Bermuda grass in that some people really, really love it in a lawn, and I'm one of those people. Other folks consider it a pretty undesirable weed. So sounds to me like you're in the first camp, which is great. I'm a big fan of it. I think that it does a lot in terms of reducing the requirements for supplemental nitrogen that we often have with the grasses we use in northern Utah. So I think it's a great option.
And can I just throw seeds onto the lawn this time of year and water it and let it go?
You can do that. You know, this time of year, often people are doing some raking, getting out any clippings that might have hung around from the last growing season. And I would recommend doing that before you throw out the seed. But yeah, you can do that and get it going.
Okay. And I'm trying to basically be as organic as possible. I have kids and chickens, and I don't really like the nasty chemicals. What can I use on my lawn if I don't want to use like regular fertilizer? Can I use like fish emulsion and whatnot? Or
you can fish emulsion and any kind of compost.
Oh, okay. Like from my garden, just toss it out there in a fine layer kind of thing?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, fantastic. Great.
Great. Well, thanks for your question.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us on the Zesty Garden. Kelly Cope is USU's Water Conservation and Turf Grass Specialist. Oh, my gosh.
Very good.
Turf Grass Specialist.
Very good,
and we'll
Brian.
Have you back in. Thanks,
thank
Kelly.
Thank you.
KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, KUSU FM HD1 Logan.